comes the sun, little darling, here comes the sun. I say, it's all right. It's all right.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement-building show. Our first comrade, because we don't have guests, is Dr. Beverly Wright. She's a professor of sociology and the founding director of the Deep South Center on Environmental Justice. Was originally at Xavier University and is now at Dillard University. Dr. Wright, one of the reasons we have her on the show today is because Channing Martinez and I are going to be going to the Historically Black Colleges and Universities Climate Justice Conference, which is very important. It's going to be happening in New Orleans this weekend. And I was just going through the names of the Historically Black Colleges and Universities. There are 100 in the United States. Approximately 303,000 is the number that I was giving. But just going through Morehouse College, Spelman College, Clark Atlanta and University, all in Atlanta. Dillard, of course, in New Orleans, which we'll talk about, Fisk in Nashville and all the work that Dr. Lawson did there, Florida A&M, Grambling State University, and yes, I have to think about football and Eddie Robinson, sorry.
I'm a Grambling alum, by the way.
Oh, you are?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so I think I said the right thing. Among other things, Jackson State University, where, you know, for a lot of white people, there was Kent State, but for us, Jackson State, also Jackson. The murders of Jackson State. Lincoln University, where Julian Bond's father was the president and Julian went to college. Morgan State University, where a black teacher that I work with and disagreed with, she said, I got mine and yours is to get, she said to the young black students. She said, I went to Morgan State University and blah, blah, blah. North Carolina A&T, the center of course, the sit-ins. Shaw University, with we went to the 50th anniversary of SNCC. Southern University, Texas Southern University, where our colleague, Dr. Robert Bullard, who's also going to be at the conference. Tougaloo is such an amazing institution. Tuskegee, Xavier. I mean, when we say historically black colleges and universities, we're talking about historic, not just historically, institutions in the whole civil rights movement. Tell us about why you've made the investment in HBCUs in general before we get to the conference.
Well, for one thing, I am an HBCU alum and a strong supporter of HBCUs because I'm interested in making certain that our young people understand why they are here and that it is a privilege and an honor to have attended one of these schools where we are taught to give back to your community. That's one of the main things that I was taught at Grambling. It had to do with service, making certain that the community was taken care of, and to move the moral compass of this country with your work to a place where every human life is valued. So HBCUs serve an important role because the majority of the students there are African American, and we need our young people to be connected to to our universe and the things that affect us. Secondly, I was also driven to start this conference at an HBCU based on my experience of traveling to the global climate conferences and not seeing African Americans present. I saw every other ethnic group, and when I did see an African American, they were not black and green, if you know what I mean. They really weren't talking our language about the impact of climate on our communities. So I was driven, first of all, to start an environmental justice corps that never was funded by any of the agencies that we tried to get money for. And then we tried to do a climate corps, and it was never funded by anyone. So I decided that I would take $10,000 that I had in one of my grants and use it to pull together about 8 colleges and universities, HBCUs, and start this conference. We're now on our 4th year, and we're now up to 22 universities involved. Next year will be our 5th anniversary. We're hoping that it's a very big one, and we want to have at least 50 HBCUs involved for our fifth year anniversary, but it's about raising awareness our young people about climate and environmental justice.
Beverly, let me ask you this. I mean, you know, historically there's been within the HBCUs the struggle between, we'll say, the Booker T. Washington theory and the W.E.B. Du Bois theory. You know, we all know, because we're on this show, Voices from the Frontlines, we are totally, totally invested in the HBCU experiment, and that's how I consider it. It's a great experiment. What's the work that you and Dr. Board have been doing to push the universities even more in a strong anti-corporate, strong focusing, as you have, on the low-income black working class and communities? Everything's a struggle. Tell us a little bit about the work you're doing and the struggle you're having, because that's one of the reasons I think this conference is of such great significance.
Yes, well, when I first started out, believe it or not, almost 22 years ago now, or is it 23 years, at Xavier University, I was trying to bring to our universities this model that I call a communiversity. And that's a model where we get our universities more involved with the struggles of people on the ground, oftentimes on the streets adjacent to their universities. This has been a struggle for a long time, but when you think about the civil rights movement, a lot of the people who came to be leaders came out of our HBCU. So there is that connect, and then there is also a disconnect. So getting the university to buy into expending more time and money within its own community was not easy. Dr. Francis at Xavier University, to his credit, embraced the concept, and the center was started there. Our struggle was finding ways to engage our college professors in all of the different sciences to do work with communities, while at the same time on their campuses, they were on 10 different committees teaching four preparations. So HBCU faculty are already overworked. So then here you come with something else for them to do, to connect to motivate students around. After about 3 years on campus, word began to seep out, you know, about the things that we were doing. And people began to ask questions about their own health or about the health of their families who lived upriver. That then made us very popular on campus. And I always say this, once a community is aware, I have never seen them make a bad choice when they have the information that they need to make that choice. So I took that same position on the campus. Bob and I, Dr. Robert Bullard and I, was hand-in-hand at our two universities on these projects. He at that time at Clark Atlanta, I was at Xavier, now I'm at Dillard, and he is at Texas Southern, and we have continued our struggle to develop a pipeline of young people interested in working in environmental justice, environmental policy, environmental law, but all through an equity lens. Whatever they do, we present this in such a way that they have this equity lens to evaluate things. So I always ask students, if you get some job at Shell, the question you should always ask if they pull you into these boardrooms, who will be affected by whatever decision is being made? And it sounds odd, but I had one young student who ended up working for Shell. She had resisted, but she got a job in environmental something. And she said in the rooms they would always ask her, what would Dr. Wright say about this project? What do you think? What resistance will we get? You know, what direction should we go in? And just recently, with a particular project, she called me. She said, Dr. Wright, I told them that this was a bad project. It was going to hurt people, and they decided against it. So you look at something that's really tiny. So 20 years ago, this young lady worked with me at Xavier. She became an environmental lawyer, and now she works for one of the big companies, and they rely on her for environmental decisions. And she is using that equity lens in directing them to move forward. Now, of course, you know, I want us to stop taking fossil fuels out of the ground, period. She is there as well, but we know that there's a process. So we are trying to infiltrate all of these agencies with our seed that can maybe push the boundaries a little bit more to get us where we want to be, and that's off of fossil fuels completely.
Well, let's move right on that, because the name of the conference, as I understand, is Bridging the Gap Between Theory and Experience. Tell us a little bit about some of the environmental science, some of the concepts that you and Dr. Board and others, what are some of the politics that you would like the climate justice movement to have? And what are some of the struggles with other forces in the movement that explain some of those disagreements?
Yeah, well, you know, when we talk about climate justice, I could go at this in a number of ways, but I just want to make something perfectly clear in our struggle is that we have had to struggle to be at the table with the big green group. And there's always a point where we are called in at the end of the conversation, so they've made a decision. Then they call us in to get us to sign on to their letters. So we have had some huge standoffs with some of the environmental groups. We seem to be coming closer together now than where we were. But, you know, when you looked at cap and trade, where they were willing to sell all our communities down the river to sign an agreement, and we refused to sign on, that agreement did not move forward without our help. So I think that was one of the first lessons with the cap and trade agreement. We are tired of being the sacrifice zone, so you want to move for a cleaner environment. So there is a way to get to that, but if that way does not take into the consideration that we are being less protected with your new rules, although overall greenhouse gases are coming down, we're not going to support it. Because once again, we see ourselves as being the sacrificial lamb in any discussion on moving forward. For the greater good, we're always the ones left behind. So that has been a struggle in the movement. It's been a struggle to get funding for the work that we do on the ground with people. And, of course, there's always the battle of the green group deciding that diversification is hiring one black person to work in their organization to work with black people, as opposed to monies going to black people on the ground, all Latinos, doing their own natives, doing their own work. So that has been a struggle, and that will continue to be the struggle. When we look at our colleges and universities and wanting to be involved in divestment from fossil fuels, that's a serious struggle for us because our schools don't have the big bucks that some of the large universities have. So we have to come up with some method of replacing monies that will be lost when we ask them to divest. And that is a discussion that will be going on, you know, at the conference led by young students from Howard University. They have a divestment campaign that they're trying to get moving on their campuses, but on their campus. But we have many young people who are involved directly in climate and EJ struggles with communities battling toxins and communities fighting coastal erosion, in particular where their neighborhoods are disappearing. So it's always a struggle when you're at what's considered a traditional university and you're coming in with what's considered to some extent radical kinds of views or radical changes. I have somehow been able to walk that line so that the universities accept and appreciate me, but it is a difficult one to walk. So in the work that I do, I always say that the point is to keep your eye on the prize. Don't get pulled off to the side. If there's an argument, you have disagreements, but you agree on one thing, we move forward on the one thing we agree on. And so we have been in existence now for almost 25 years, and I think we're almost the last. We were the first HBCU environmental justice community university center using that model, and we are, to some extent, the last one standing in that Bullard closed his shop, but he's still doing all of the same work at Texas Southern, but not under the rubric of an environmental justice center.
Do you feel like naming names of some of the big green groups that you've had struggles with?
One of the big green groups that we had struggles with was the Sierra Club in particular. And I would say that the Sierra Club at this point has made the largest move to diversify, having the first black president with Aaron Mayer and giving Bob the Sierra Club Award. So we have struggled with them because they've gotten large amounts of money from private donors to do EJ, and we have not seen that money coming back into our communities. We've seen them hire one person, you know, to lead up the environmental justice component of their programming, but there have been struggles with the Sierra Club for a very long time. The National Wildlife Federation, you know, with its emphasis being mostly on wildlife and not at all dealing with environmental justice issues. So there have been some serious problems, long-standing issues. In fact, at our first People of Color Summit, Dana Alston, who was a soldier in our movement, addressed the question of diversity and the question of money being given to minority groups to fight their own battle. The end of that conversation led to her firing from the organization that she was with, but then she was rehired. So it's been a hard battle. And at this particular conference, for the first time, I would say, since that discussion in the 90s was had, we are having a similar discussion at this conference dealing with white allies and what those relationships would look like as we speak about the big green group. So NRDC will be there, Sierra Club will be there, and there are a few others that I forget, but we are going to have that conversation. And having that conversation with young people, I think, is critical, because young people need to understand the dynamics of the relationship between big green groups and our environmental justice movement.
Well, we in Los Angeles have had a lot of struggle, for instance, with NRDC, because, as an example, way, way back, they supported the buying and selling of air pollution credits, and we opposed it.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're saying, Beverly, for our listeners who may think, quote, cap and trade sounds great, what that means is basically if you want to pollute, and theoretically under this market theory, you have to buy a credit from somebody who theoretically is not polluting, and therefore you can get money. But, of course, that means if you want to pollute in a black community, all you have to do is buy a credit, and you have a credit that allows you to poison the people in the black community, because the theory is, well, what's the problem? Overall, the emissions are going down. I even question, by the way, whether or not the emissions are going down, because they also, at the same time they passed cap and trade in Los Angeles, they got rid of the inspection department. So there was no way to even monitor if there was a true reduction in the emissions. But so we've had this struggle with NRDC. We've had a struggle with NRDC that they support rail in Los Angeles. They have not been actively supporting the bus riders union lately. They were at one point. So these struggles are not just in the past. They are in the present. I can't wait to hear the conference. This is a good reason for me and Chan. I think you know Channing Martinez and I will do everything we can to help turn up some heat in that conversation.
Yes, the heat is expected. I don't believe they feel they could come to a conference like this and not feel the heat. So the heat is absolutely to be expected. But I want to make certain that our young people have the knowledge, you know, so that they can turn up the heat. A lot of times our kids don't know about the struggle. Environmental Action, Anthony Rogers Runt, will be heading up this particular discussion. So I don't know if he or the young people know the long history, because they're younger people. So I want to make certain that in those discussions we're able to bring up the longer history of this fight. It didn't just start around climate justice, you know, last year. It's been going on for a long time, and it continues.
Well, to end this conversation, this wonderful conversation, This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontline. The voice from the frontline you're hearing is Dr. Beverly Wright, presently at Dillard University. She's also the head of the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice. When the Strategy Center was first formed, and yeah, it was my first little foray into the funding world, a little tiny organization, and you know, we're trying to figure out we're doing environmental justice work down in Wilmington, and I get a call from Bob Bullard, and he says, "Hey, Eric, I got a great idea. What's that?" He says, "We're going to take on all the environmental groups." I said, "Oh, God, Bob, I just started, man. Do you have to do it the first week?" He says, "Well, you're late. Let's get moving." I said, all right, I get it." So we were involved. We were involved in the wonderful, wonderful, historic People of Color Environmental Justice Leadership Summit that you, yes, Bob Bullard, and many of our friends have. So I think we want to bring, that is 1991, I believe, bring that tradition into, as you're saying, into the HBCU Climate Justice Conference that's happening this week in New Orleans. I'd like you to end with just clarifying, because we had a wonderful conversation in Paris, Beverly, as explain to our listeners why you and Bob Bullard, among others, have been fighting for a Black-centered and have challenged the concept of people of color as it's been used, frankly, against Black people, which was not its intent.
Yes. Well, I don't know if we've talked so much, Eric. I'm not certain I'm going to say the right thing, but you know that I have problems with the term person of color because I think it basically homogenizes all of us and it takes away our own identity and lumps us into one. But in the Deep South especially, we think it was important to have a center, the Deep South Center at an HBCU, a Black school, because the South is different. It's different from other places. Although some of the other places are beginning to sound like the South, it still just is not the South. So there are some curious methods and means of discriminating against people in the South and a certain degree of acceptance of that as normal, not only by white people, but by African Americans as well, because it's been done this way forever and ever. And so since this is the place where the majority of African Americans are being poisoned in the Deep South, it's important that African Americans lead that struggle, because we know better how this structure works and how it is oppressing us and how it continues to harm, you know, our health and our communities more so than anyone else.
Well, thank you so
much. That's what we talked about, but that's what I remember, Eric.
Yeah, absolutely, Beverly. You always have the right answers, so don't worry. I mean, I think to reinforce, I want to say that when we had the first People of Color Environmental Justice Leadership Summit, it was an amazing concept, and it was very strongly Black-led. There was also tremendous Latino and Asian Pacific Islander participation. We come out of the tradition of taking on the white system in every way. So we take that for granted in some way. That's the main danger, is white chauvinism. Mm-hmm. But within that struggle, mm-hmm, as you were saying about homogenizing, we have to understand that the system will say very specifically, I hired an Asian person and say to the Black person, what's the problem? I hired, mm-hmm, a person of color. Or, mm-hmm, I gave a grant to a Latino group. What is the problem?
Yes,
you're a person of color. And the Black person is saying, wait a minute. I'm glad you gave the money. That wasn't what the argument was, but please don't use the term people of color to form another form of way of excluding Black people. And
you know
we're totally on your side with you. We look forward to seeing you in New Orleans this weekend. Thank you more than I can
explain.
You know, absolutely. Looking forward to it. And thank you so much for being on Voices from the Frontlines.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you. And good evening, everyone.
Take good care of yourself.
And now the end is near. And so I got to face the final curtain. Friends, I'll say it clear and state my case. of which I'm certain, I've lived a life that's full. I've traveled.